You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome back to our final panel of the day on education diplomacy and girls' education. This is a particularly interesting topic to me personally, as I've been doing a bit of thinking on how education diplomacy as a sort of skill set, a set of competencies, might enable girls' education leaders to do their work more effectively, and especially in terms of influencing national-level policymakers, community-level decision-makers, all for the goal of sustainable and transformative social change for girls. So leading our panel today is our moderator, Diane Whitehead. She is the Executive Director of the Association for Childhood Education International, and I'll let her introduce our panelists.
All right. Thank you so much, Christina. Yep, this is on. You can hear me. And it's the last session of the day. It's been an invigorating, interesting, incredible day. We've heard a lot about leadership, about advocacy efforts that are happening around girls' education, and all kinds of new and innovative ways of working together. So it's sort of appropriate that we end the day with a session on girls' education and education diplomacy. I'm really happy here to be talking about this as we think through the skills that girls' education leaders really need in order to be more effective. We've been doing some thinking with Dr. Kwok and others at Brookings about this education diplomacy approach. So I would like to first introduce my panelists, and then I'll come back and give a little bit of an introduction from my perspective about what education diplomacy is. So we have a wonderful panel with us today. On my right, we have Christine Apiat Akudi, and she's the Director of Academics at Bridge International Academies in Uganda. Welcome, Christine. And we have Desmond Kennedy. And she is the Deputy Chief Education Officer and School Operations, and she's acting in that position currently from Jamaica. And we have Nima Shering, who is the former Professional Assistant to His Majesty, the King of Bhutan. Welcome, Nima. And we also have Judith Ann Walker, who's the Executive Director of Development Research and Project Center in Nigeria. So welcome, Judith Ann. And so the question we're going to hope to tackle today is, what is education diplomacy? So at the Association for Childhood Education International, we began thinking about education diplomacy a few years ago. So we developed a Center for Education Diplomacy, which has just really is really starting its takeoff and launch at this moment in time. And we were really trying to think about education transformation. How does that happen? And when we thought about sort of the current approaches to that transformation, we thought, well, there's education leadership, and there's education advocacy. But it seemed like something was missing in that. So when you think about leadership, we sort of think about things like direction setting and strategy planning and guiding and supervising and managing and inspiring. Leadership is important. And advocacy, sort of voicing our opinions, our needs, our desires, even making demands sometimes for change. And that sometimes can be a very kind of a one-way sort of a conversation, especially when it gets to sort of putting forth our demands for change. But education diplomacy we think of as being more transactional, sort of a two-way conversation, a two-way interaction. So I really see education diplomacy as sitting within that continuum of leadership to advocacy. It's related, but it also has its own separate skill set and place within this education transformation toolbox, so to speak. So it's got its own set of skills, sets of knowledge, and really works to both within the education sector and then intersectorally as well with other sectors that involve with education. So what are some of the things we think about when we think about education, diplomacy, and the skills? Well, it's the sorts of things that we've all been talking about today, really. It's collaboration, consensus building, coordination, compromising, negotiating, building relationships, building trust, communication, active listening, partnering, all the skills that we think of in a diplomat. Or a diplomatic person. And when I say diplomat and diplomacy, I'm not talking about official foreign affairs diplomats. We're talking about a diplomatic disposition. So things like tact, understanding, sensitivity, respect for local context and culture. All of these things are very important, including things for an education diplomat, it's important to be thinking forward, thinking about future trends and thinking about how we communicate effectively and thinking about how we listen actively and thinking about political circumstances of nations and economic and social circumstances of communities. So all these things are important. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a taste of it. Education diplomacy does acknowledge the growing number of actors in the education space as well. It takes its lead and its purpose from the SDGs. We know when we look at the SDGs, our partnership and collaboration is critically important. And finding ways to work together to influence positive change with stakeholders, to be able to come to agreement, to solve education challenges. So given all of this, how do we work in new and dynamic ways using education diplomacy to improve skills for girls' education leaders in order to make progress on this very important topic that we're talking about? So I've given you a little bit of an introduction to education diplomacy. We've certainly introduced our panelists, and I would like to thank them for being here. They're all former Echidna Scholars alumni, and so I'm very proud, actually, to be up here with them. So let's get started. And we don't know where this session is going to go, quite frankly. We're going to take it wherever it leads because this is a new concept, new approach. So feel free. We will have Q&A at the end. Feel free to jump in with your thoughts and questions about education diplomacy. So when we think about education diplomacy and the types of skills that I was just mentioning, I'd love you each to talk about an experience that you've had where you had to use some of those skill sets to move ahead an agenda or a policy or a program or an initiative for girls' education. Okay, so let's see, where should we begin? I think I'll just begin right here on my right with Christine. Okay, and you have just a few minutes to answer this question, right? And then we're going to jump in and dive into the meat of it together, okay?
Thank you, Diane. Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to give my experience specifically talking about my relationship with government and working with government. I've had quite a number of times approach government for several issues, and one thing I learned is that with government, you have to take things slow. There's the whole bureaucratic process around it. There's respect to offices as you go up the ladder. You have to be patient. You have to be very persuasive. So where am I coming from? Before I came for my residency here in Brookings, I was working for an organization that was implementing a Girls Education Challenge project. And within this project, I was working with female teachers to support girls' education. And I noticed that there was a position of a lady teacher in every school to support girls' education. But I didn't know how I was supposed to work with this teacher to support girls' education. I approached the Ministry of Education on this, and obviously the answer was, yes, there's a policy, it's somewhere, you get it. And I'm asking, where? And it's the all they can say is it's there. So when I had the opportunity to come to Brookings, I decided to do research on all the policies and try and understand where did this come from. I know, obviously, in the back of my mind that because we come from a very patrilineal society, it has been so hard for girls to relate with males, teachers or anybody else. So it was important to have a female teacher in school. So how this, how this rule came into place had something to do with that. So after my residency here, I was able to get all the necessary proof, evidence, and I went back to the Ministry of Education. Why I went to the Ministry of Education? Because I had written a policy brief, and I know that if ever I have to move the paper to the next level, these are the movers and shakers around this. So fortunately, in the Ministry of Education, we have the gender unit, which is charged with the duty of mainstreaming initiatives in gender in the school. So I went back there and said, you know what? There's no policy document. I have researched, all the evidence is there, but this is still a very good thing that you're doing. How can we put it to the next level? Fortunately, she understood, she appreciated the work that I had done, and she gave me an opportunity to meet with the gender working group of the Ministry of Education. These are the main actors in children education and girl education. So we have the UNICEF, Save the Children, World Vision, Raising Voices, name it. They sit on this group, and they're the ones that are supporting the Ministry of Education to push issues around children's education. I was able to present my research to them, tell them about what I intended to do and what support I needed from them. Unfortunately enough, many of them were able to recognize the fact that we actually needed a policy document around female teachers in schools and use them to support girls' education. The Ministry of Education has now been able to give me the opportunity to proceed with this document. We have gone down to the regional levels, had consultative meetings with the government officers and the local leaders at that level, got their feedback and understanding on how they feel we should be using these teachers to support a girl's education. And in a week or two, I will also be meeting with the parliamentarians and giving back all this feedback to see to it how we can push for a policy around girls' education and support. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. And that's a wonderful example of how you went through a process of education diplomacy. And that's a sort of an important point. Education diplomacy actually isn't something that we do just one time or something we are working on, you know, through just a couple of steps. It's actually a process. And that process, we have to understand, takes time. We have to be committed to kind of putting in the time to make the change move forward at a pace that's comfortable for those that we're actually working with. Because we don't want to, as Christine and I were talking earlier, we don't want to ruffle feathers. If you're taking a diplomatic approach, you are working very sensitively with others. So it's a great example. Thank you, Christine. We'll come back to you in just a moment. So Dasmeen, we'll come to you next.
Thank you very much, Diane. Good afternoon, colleagues. Thank you for bearing with us in this moment. I consider my situation very peculiar and more so contextual, more so because in Jamaica we pride ourselves on having attained universal access to education, and hence when this whole issue about gender inclusiveness and all the discussions surrounding gender education, then I was the first to say that we don't have an issue in Jamaica. But then I started asking deep questions, and then I recall that we have a policy which facilitates the reintegration of school-age mothers in the formal school system. So I wanted to know, well, yes, we have access, but do we have equity, and are we achieving at the different levels? So I wanted to know how well this policy was being implemented, what have been the gains, and what are the gaps. So my first attempt was to, first I must say I work in government. So this gave me a starting point, a unique starting point to interrogate the policy. So I sought the audience of the policymakers there, which includes my Minister of Education, and he himself was very interested. So there I got the buy-in to start with. And then I had to engage all the different actors and players, and we call them gatekeepers, who were responsible for first the development of the policy and then implementation at the different levels. And also, I had to drill down to the level of the girls to see how well they were benefiting and what have been their results over time. So for me, I have been working using this terminology or this approach or technique very well in the space without actually realizing that I was being very diplomatic about this process. So even when I came to Brookings and I was provided with the opportunity to drill deeper into this whole reintegration program and develop this wonderful policy brief, then I could not sit with it. I have to take it back to the critical players. And one of the first things that I thought to do was to ensure that all the partnering agencies, ministries benefited from a copy. And by the time the document starts circulating, then request came. Even though Brookings only gave me 15 copies, but they went to all the critical persons. So I was so amazed. And then even from my own level, having the benefit of working in government, and then my position is also critical because I get to interface with persons who are making plans for education and also national development. And every forum that presents itself to me, I will use the platform to speak about girls reintegration and how well we are serving them and what is it that we are not doing well. And I continue to lobby using the advocacy approach. So it was just last week, I was invited to make a presentation to a group of stakeholders regarding my findings as per the benefits of the policy, how well we have done, and what were the gaps. And while I was there, I noticed that every single participant had a media kit. And when I looked in it, everything that were entrenched in my policy, the findings and the recommendations for going forward, they were all carefully documented in that press kit. And then by the time I got the opportunity to speak, I realized that the forum was really created for me to speak and to share what was happening. And then that was a stealing moment. And it is very interesting to relate that every single thing that I have recommended in that document, plans are now on the way to have every single one of them implemented. And this now brings me back to the point that if we ever have any significant change to make in society, we cannot operate in silos. We have to engage all the critical partners, and then we have to get persons involved in such a way so that everybody knows their part. And from there, we can achieve great things. So education diplomacy is very active in Jamaica, and we have laid the platform for achieving even greater things. I thank you.
Thank you so much, Jasmine. And it's really interesting to hear about the way that you went about creating change using diplomatic approaches, all the actors and stakeholders that you had to, sort of the layers that you had to move through. And also the fact that, you know, again, it's a process, right? And it's a process that takes a little bit of time, but certainly takes kind of the strategic kind of movement, right? You have to plan it out. You have to know who those stakeholders are. You have to understand them. So thank you so much, and we'll come back in just a moment, okay? All right, Nima, tell us about your education diplomacy experience in Bhutan.
Thank you, Diane. It's 3 a.m. in Bhutan, so I'm going to be a little bit loud to keep myself awake after having traveled 21 hours in the plane. I thought I started from there on November 6th, and I'm still here on November 6th when I arrived. So, but thank you so much. Educating girls is normal, a new normal, not an exception. This was what I learned in 2014 when I was at Brookings. So after 4 years, it feels good to be back in Brookings. I feel at home because this is the home where I got that idea with the confidence and clarity that believe that educating girls is not an exception, it's a normal, a new normal. And I take no credit. I owe that confidence in me to Rebecca, to Christina. I know Jenny has left, Jenny Gamble, Amanda, Alain, and of late, Tamrin. So I've been drawing that motivation. And you can see, you know, all of my leaders are women. So that was fast forward. I believe in that. Since, or maybe I'm being an education diplomat now. Since 2014, I haven't done anything actually much. You see my title is still former assistant to King of Bhutan. I haven't changed last 4 years. This is because I've been doing lots of things informally to get things done. And I have actually interesting story to tell. Krishna will remember when I applied for Brookings, Jenny and the team, they interviewed me on the phone. I said, please give me an opportunity. I know there may be lots of bright and, men and women, girls and boys, they must be applying. I said, give me a chance because I'm from Bhutan and I want to come back to Bhutan. And I said, I would like to imagine myself as a piece of sand. And if you are a piece of sand, would you like to be a sand on the beach? Or would you like to be sand in the eye of the person? And I said, I would like to be the sand in the eye of a person. So if I can't make a difference, I will at least irritate first people who can make a difference to make a difference. And this is exactly what I have been doing. I say with all honesty, because if you're in America or in, for that matter, China, many countries, no. If you're one in a million, if it's in China, there are already 1,300 just like you. If you are one in a million in India, there are already 1,200 just like you. If you are one in a million in Bhutan, you are just half. because we even don't have 1 million population. So this is the motivation I've drawn. So Krishna will remember, in my research, I was assessing the state of girls' education in Bhutan. And having done lots of research with, thank you for being patient, with so much the advice from Krishna and the team, I went with the 3 recommendations in my research to improve girls' education, or at least to transform the girls' education in Bhutan. One recommendation was, I'm jumping to the recommendation, that I wanted to promote, or at least like advocate for the policy, a girl-friendly boarding school. That was one recommendation. Second recommendation was, in Bhutan's national education policy, there is a policy called after 10th grade, which is middle secondary school. When you go to high secondary school, there's a clause which says government will take only minimum 40% of the cohort to the next level. So I was trying to change that second. And third was that there was a quality issue in the adolescent's age. So there are social norms, there are household chores, other things. So there are 3 things. When I went back in 2014, in 2015, using a little bit of diplomacy here and there, so I was able to insert the exact recommendation, girl-friendly boarding school. And government actually now constructed 60 such boarding school in Bhutan, and they have planned to double. This is in Bhutan, it's nationwide, it's a lot. This so I use that that going back the diplomacy to talk to the minister who was actually trying to change the education blueprint for quality, from access to quality. And that transition I used to insert the girls' agenda. So that was one. But the other two were left out. So last 3 years, what we have been doing was I was looking for another transitions, so trying to talk to all the stakeholders. And in Bhutan, we became democracy in 2008. So 2013 was the second election, and 2018 is the third election. So last 3 years, I've been I haven't taken any formal job by choice, because I don't want to be in the government, because I want to work with the NGO. I don't want to be NGO because I want to work with the private. I don't want to be in private because I want to work with the government. So now I don't know what I was doing. My wife will say that. My friends are asking, where are you working? And I'm feeling, ashamed, because I can't say where you're working. You're all over. I couldn't find my title. After Krishna sent me the five-level framework, education diplomacy, I just found a title for myself, freelance education diplomat.
Yes.
So to fast forward.
So we may have to fast forward. because we want to make sure Judith Ann gets the turn.
In 2003 election, third party outside the parliament just got elected as a ruling government. All my colleagues. Today, November 7th, new prime minister is taking the inauguration, the office. And I chose to be here because I say I don't want to be in the illusion of political grandeur. I have done my work. And I'm going to go to Brookings to instill new ideas. So here I am.
That's wonderful.
So they have adopted this girl changing the other two recommendations as the main national debate agenda. So it's no more mainstreaming the gender or mainstreaming girls' education. It was drawing the battle in the girls' field. So,
all right. Yeah. No, thank you so much. And you can see Nima's education diplomacy approach is one where he can use building relationships, right? And he talked about building friendships as well with the main kind of decision makers, right, that he was working with. So we can definitely see that approach. And I told you we didn't know where this session was going to go. So I was right. Thank you, Nima. Thank you so much. So Judith Ann, please tell us about your education experience as well in relation to girls' education.
Thank you very much. After this, I'm not quite sure. So the year was 2016. The month was December. And the organization I founded and led and still lead was implementing the SIPSI project funded by the MacArthur Foundation. We designed a very ambitious activity. And in December, we sought to bring all the states who were working under the education, the GPE program funded through the World Bank mechanism. So there were five states, and we were bringing all of them together, and we were going to do gender mainstreaming training. In the previous year, we had done a baseline study, and we realized that all the education sector plans have very significant components on gender. That's at the level of the policy framing. But in terms of implementation, gender was off the table. It was nowhere there. So we decided very ambitiously that we were going to train all these five states in Nigeria, five independent states, to train them on gender mainstreaming. MacArthur advised us, are you sure you want to do this? Yes. What are your outcomes? It's in the results framework. We are sure we will have the outcome we want. Nonetheless, we began in December. We had a strategic opportunity in the sense that one of the states had just come back from a study tour to Bangladesh. Katsina State, which has very poor education outcomes for girls in particular, and access, all the indices you look at were very poor for girls, had just come back from a study tour to Bangladesh, and they were enthused. The civil servants were very committed. They wanted to make a change. So we said, well, they're one of the five GPE states, so let's just bring them in, and we showcase them, because they came back with this clear commitment and this five-point agenda of what they were going to do on gender. So we brought them in. and we showcased them, and we said, this is this, you know, wonderful state that has made this commitment, and we want all the other states likewise to talk about how you are really, truly going to integrate gender into your implementation plans. So it's a forum, you know, we talk, we meet for 4 days, and we hope that at the end of the day, we catalyze that change. But when we thought about it, we knew that we couldn't catalyze that change. We needed to do some other things. And the other things we did is that rather than bringing great committed civil society activists, we brought in a federal government agency. So what's the purpose of that? The federal government agency can hold them to account. They have more gravitas. They are more recognized and respected. And if the state-level agencies say they are going to do something, it just the mere fact that the federal is there makes the difference. So we had them in the room. They did the training. They co-created and co-facilitated the entire exercise with us. And at the end of the day, we got all the states, including the state that had just gone to Bangladesh, to commit. Not only were they going to do what they said they were going to do, but they are going to use these techniques and approaches to ensure that gender is mainstreamed. So we left and we said, well, we have achieved something, you know, they've all committed. We have these statements of commitments, these action plans. And to a large extent, we could have said that we have transformed the problem, that they will go back to their states and that we will have some semblance of gender mainstreaming. But then we weren't sure about that. We knew that we had monitoring and evaluation tools we can follow and track, but we still were not sure. Then we realized that GPE in DC had picked up our activity and it was on their website. So it wasn't intentional, but we saw it there. So we pulled that off and we said to them, hey, GPE is watching you. You need to do better and you need to achieve every single thing you said you were going to do. So we used that leverage. We never had any formal contact with GPE, but the mere fact that we found it on the website, we were just, you know, blown away, and that was the leverage that we had. Then when we were having the meetings and the conversations, the group that came back from Bangladesh, they kept saying, you know, one of the things we saw is that BRAC made such a difference. To be able to work with a partner like BRAC, that made such a difference. They kept talking about it. It was transformative for them to have a partner that could provide the technical support, could co-create with them. So what we did, you know, I had been here as a fellow in 2013. And as a scholar, I met several people and I met somebody from BRAC. So I found the card of the BRAC person and I wrote them and I said, listen, we, the NGOs that are putting pressure on these, you know, government agencies to perform, they don't have the exposure and the knowledge and the experience as BRAC. Would you just, you know, team up and talk with them? And fine, no problem. So the engagement began. BRAC was talking to the NGOs that were working in those states, and those states have NGOs, but they are not as well exposed and don't have all the skills and the capacity. But the BRAC friend did a wonderful job, and the NGOs were motivated and mobilized, and they kept on saying to the state government, this is what you promised to do in terms of gender mainstreaming. Have you been doing it? And again and again, now it is 3 years since that time, about 2.5 really. And what we've done is that when we go back and we do a monitoring and when we do a tracking or we talk with them, because we actually monitor this program, in almost every case, what they've promised to deliver in terms of mainstreaming gender, formally, in terms of a plan or program or lofty idea, but in terms of the management mechanisms, which is so very important, that if you are planning, how many women do you have in the room? How many female teachers do you have in the room? I mean, what do you disaggregate your data in terms of male and female?
Judith,
they are doing it.
We may have to move on, but this is absolutely wonderful. So you can see I've let them go on a little bit longer. Let's take a couple of questions because we'll do Q&A as well, but I would like to get to a couple of the questions that we had. And actually, at this time of the day, it's really wonderful to hear the stories, I think. So hopefully that this arrangement is working for you as well. So I would like to ask, when we're diagnosing, you know, one of the things we talk about with education diplomacy is the need to diagnose a challenge. How do you know that the challenge that you're working on is the challenge that you really need to work on. So I'm going to ask a couple of you to answer that question, and then I've got another question that I'll ask. So Christine, when you're thinking about identifying or diagnosing a challenge for girls' education, how do you do that in a diplomatic way?
I like that. I'll give an example of my experience.
And it has to be brief.
Yes. I was able to identify my challenge because there was a need. And I was able to see that need and bring it to the table and find actually everybody recognized that very same need, but nobody had done anything about it. So I then definitely had to think about who are the people who could make a difference if I approached them. And that is how I zeroed down on the gender unit of the Ministry of Education as the people who are rightly placed to mainstream initiatives in gender and at school level.
Well, thank you so much. So you're really sort of looking at who's the target, right, and who holds that decision-making power, which is important to identify, and to identify, of course, the challenge as well. Let's have Desmin speak to that, Ursa.
Oh, thank you. For us to actually achieve the set targets that the policy was supposed to achieve, then it has to get down to the implementation level so that the girls can benefit who are so affected. And then every single critical player had to play a role. So in my quest to diagnose the issues, then I had to do the drill down at the different levels. Because one, I had to find out what was in place at the policy level to ensure and to interrogate the data to ensure that we were achieving what we set out to achieve. Then I had to drill down to the implementation level, where at the regional levels, you know, we have different players such as school administrators, guidance counselors within the institutions, guidance counselors at the regional level, and drill down to the girls themselves and also to their parents to see how aware they were of the policy and whether or not.
So it was a drilling down sort of a technique.
Drilling down and to ensure that everybody who is supposed to have some part to play in this whole implementation process, that they were so involved.
Right, to make people feel a part, right, of the implementation process.
And that's the time when I realized, yes, we have a really wonderful policy, but the implementation was not happening.
Okay, yeah. So Nima and Judith Ann, I'm going to ask you very quickly and to address what are some of the key skills that you use in your education diplomacy approach when you're working on these girls' education issues, and it does have to be relatively quick. So one word or phrases will be fine. What do you think of when you think about the types of skills, consensus building or?
Based on my lived experiences, the players are many. You have to treat everybody equal. Okay. From the topmost to the students, if you are girls. Every player you have to treat equal, and you have to negotiate. A difference between, I guess, advocacy and diplomacy. In diplomacy, you have to go soft with everybody. You have to step one step back and listen. Make yourself powerless while pushing the evidence. So that's my experience.
Okay. Thank you so much, Nima. And Judith Ann?
I will say building trust.
Building trust. Okay. Right. And that is something that we talk about a lot in our education diplomacy model, is that need to build trust, and what Nima said as well, that need to make sure that everybody's being treated sort of equally within that process. So these are all interrelated types of skills. What do you think about the challenges of an education diplomacy approach? What are the challenges to some of that approach? And I'll go to Dasmin. Because it sounds wonderful, doesn't it? We talk about consensus building and we're not going to work in silos and we're going to do cross-sectorial work and cross-cultural, actually, communication and all these types of things. But what are the challenges?
Well, for me and my context, the difficulty comes in when persons are not fully aware of the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And more so, if a particular policy is not implemented, what are the implications for the beneficiaries and the nation overall? And for us, the overarching agenda was very critical, because in my context, we need our people to ensure national development. So the human capacity was very critical there. So when I speak from that platform, use the overarching picture, and try to drill down to see how everybody plays into this sphere. So getting buy-in can only be difficult if the platform is not properly created so that persons can actually understand what is at stake and their role in ensuring that it happens seamlessly.
So you have to create that platform, right, to get that buy-in. Like that's that phrase that we use, right? Okay. What do you see as a challenge, Judith,
big challenges.
In education, in applying an education diplomacy approach? Tell
big
us.
Big challenges. I think there's an assumption that when you talk about education diplomacy, that power is distributed equally amongst parties. And very often it's not. And in recognition of that, in Nigeria, for example, most of the development partners have moved away from saying civil society organizations should dialogue with government. They're now saying what Ovechi asked this morning. You make trouble, you hold them to account. It's not just soft diplomacy, but gunboat diplomacy. You really fire the cannons and you topple everything over, because that's what gets the attention of government and holds them to account. So while we are talking diplomacy, MacArthur Foundation and all the other funders are moving in the direction of accountability funding, and that is for hard diplomacy, not just soft, but really hard, and maybe not even diplomacy, but really holding government to account in a very strong manner.
Absolutely. So there are challenges to this, using the hard, knowing when to use the hard and soft diplomacy skills are certainly one of them, right? Let's see. Let's talk about negotiation just a second, and then we're going to move to Q&A. But negotiation is sort of a center point of diplomacy. When we think about diplomats, we think about diplomats negotiating common agreement. And that's certainly something that needs to happen in the girls' education discussions that we're having. So when you think about negotiation, is there a time where you worked through a negotiation with another party or other parties that you'd like to share quickly with us? And then we'll move to some Q&A. So anybody like to take that question? Or
yes, I'll go quickly. Because one of our critical partners in this girls' education space, and as it relates to the policy, as we realize that most of our girls that were so affected by teenage pregnancy, that they were in fact from low socioeconomic background. So we have a particular government ministry that is responsible for social protection. And so we have this mandate. But many of the girls were not benefiting from the social protection strategy, because the whole designation and the whole classification surrounding persons who should be benefiting did not apply to some of the girls. So some persons, even though they were having challenges, they were not accessing this fund. So what I had to do now is to reach out to this particular agency. I said, well, look, yes, you are providing support for some of the girls, but based on my research, all the girls are in need, not because based on your matrix, they don't measure up. And we have been having the discussion. And I am happy to report that they have tweaked their policy in such a way in that provision is now being made to provide support to the parents of the girls so that they can turn that over and do some form of investment to ensure that the girls can benefit from this particular funding.
Okay, thank you so much. So that's a very good example of negotiation and how you had to move in and kind of work with these other parties, right, to reach, to make a change, to reach consensus. So thank you for that. So with that, I think we're going to move to Q&A. We're only going to take three questions, I think, because we're on a little bit of a time crunch. So we'll take the three questions, and then we'll move forward. Okay. Let's move over here.
Thank you. My name is Tolu again from Nigeria. My question is for Judith Ann. On the work you do, how do you measure the actual outcomes on the part of the girls? A lot of work has gone into teacher training and all of that. I would say they are probably like intermediate outcomes. And I know you work in Northern Nigeria where there's an acute issue with the cultural institutions and the religion aspect. So how is this being measured? And second question quickly, the Katsina State, I also know that the Katsina State governor at that time was very progressive. So how much would you say that the commitment of political leadership impacted the outcomes with that particular state?
Thanks. That's sort of two questions. We have a measuring outcomes and then about working with the political environment. So, Judith, do you want to address those? Well, actually, no. We're not going to do that. We're taking our questions first. I forgot the Brookings process. We're taking the questions first, but Judith, we'll come back to you. Let's see. Let's go over here. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Folienka, and I'm a graduate student at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. I just had a really quick question for the panel in general. I wanted to ask what you see the role of rigorous research and data and evidence is in encouraging diplomacy and being able to back up policies and, you know, pushes for specific policies.
Thanks. Okay, thank you. And over here.
Hi, my name is Mike Larkin. I'm with the Forum on International Affairs. And my question goes to when you're building alliances with government and also trying to hold them to account at the same time, is there space for getting the parents involved, especially in those contexts where maybe the country, the locality actually has, you know, some type of democratic elections, or is that getting into too controversial territory? Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. So we'll start with Judith Ann. And we have to have fairly quick answers.
You already said it. The Katsina State governor at that time was extremely progressive, hence the reason why they were the only state that went to Bangladesh. The other states that were part of the GPE program did not go, but he found the funding and worked with the World Bank to do it. So that was a plus, and that's one of the reasons why we held them up as the model and to catalyze change amongst the other states. So the answer is there. Regarding how do you measure outcomes, how do you measure performance in a girls' education program, there are multiple indicators that you can use. I just completed a study of a 9-year project that was funded by DFID, and the interesting thing in Nigeria, they never looked at learning outcomes. They just left it aside because obviously, people know what they will find. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult to measure outcomes, the performance of an education project, girls' education project. We have several indicators that we've used in our project, and they've all been found to be satisfactory by the foundation that funds us. And they range from the outcomes, the transition, completion rates, and learning outcomes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Judith. We had the question on research, and actually we're going to turn that over to Christine.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dan. Yes, I want to say that research and evidence is very important in diplomacy. It's actually what you will communicate clearly and effectively to all the stakeholders in order for you to get their buy-in and also trust in whatever you're saying and for them to be able to take on what you're putting forward.
Okay, thank you so much. And we had a question about parents. And how do we sort of bring them right into these policy discussions and changes? And I think I'll let Dasmin, I'll have you answer quickly, and then Nima as well. Okay.
Yes. The parents, they are also critical to the process. One of the ways in which, and especially for my context, that we are going to ensure that our girls benefit fully from the policy is to ensure that they are provided with the requisite support from parents. Naturally, though, even though this particular group is very important, many of us, in my context, will have to become parents outside of our role. Because, and one of the things that I've actually committed that stakeholder group to is for everybody to mentor one of the girls. And many men were there, and I actually asked them to mentor a girl. So yes, the biological parents are very important, but many of them don't have the capacity. So we have to also use persons outside of the space to ensure that the girls benefit from the provision that is in place for them.
Okay, thank you, Jasmine. It's a really important question, this one about parents and including their voice and understanding what's needed, right? So, Nima, would you like to speak to that as well?
I'll just share the instance. Parents are very, very important diplomatically. In the case of Bhutan, we just put this like I said, class 10 to 12, until now, the free education is still class 10. And makes half of the children drop out, don't get free, and maximum of girls. So we said no cutoff point for students up to class 12. We targeted the children. But children are all 15 and 16 years old. They cannot vote. You need to be 18 years to vote. So we targeted children. Children actually pressured the parents, and especially mothers and sisters. In the case of Bhutan's recent election, it was mothers and sisters who put the third party into the ruling government. You cannot imagine in the United States, third party coming and knocking out both Democrat and Republican is equivalent to that, with due respect. So very important, parents. You push the children, they'll push the parents.
So that's probably a very good place to kind of start wrapping up our discussion, as we're all the way back to children, which is a wonderful place to be. So we know that girls' education is very, very important, and we've come together this afternoon to really talk about how working in diplomatic ways within education can really help us to advance agendas. Some of the things we've talked about include making sure that we're reaching across to work with other sectors, and that we need these diplomatic skills in order to do that. We've talked about the necessity of education diplomats to have research and data. So there are skill sets, but there's also knowledge that education diplomats need in order to be able to carry forward diplomatic approach. We've certainly talked a little bit about some of the core skills of negotiation, consensus building, negotiation, coming to common agreement, how to work with groups in order to do that. And we talked a little bit about the challenges as well. You know, the fact that education diplomacy can sound wonderful. Gaining these skill sets is certainly inspirational in itself when you're going through kind of improving your skills in some of these areas. But the fact is that it's not easy. This isn't isn't something that you have to engage in this over the longer term. It's not something you can become an education diplomat overnight. So we thank our panelists very, very much for their input. They're all wonderful education diplomats for girls' education. And thank you for being with us. I certainly appreciated the opportunity to hear from all of you. And I'd like to welcome back up to be with us is Dr. Christina Kwok, who will end our day.
Thank you, Diane, and to our panelists of Echidna Alumni. I think what is clear after this panel is the importance of education diplomacy as a set of skills or competencies that have enabled you all to make some long-standing policy change in Bhutan, in Nigeria, in Jamaica, and in Uganda. I've lost Christine. Where did she go? There you are. Okay. But you know, what you all pointed to was education diplomacy at work at one particular level, and that was really between you all and your state or your government level sector actors, and really bringing in the sort of the unconverted into the converted space, right? Really trying to get actors who may not be on board on the girls' education agenda into the girls' education agenda. I'd like to highlight two additional levels that I think we all, as a girls' education community, should be thinking about as well. This morning, we heard from another panel of Echidna alumni, was really talking about, you know, innovative partnerships and innovative approaches that they themselves were using at a local level with global actors, right? So if we think about this political moment that we're in today with high-level political champions and celebrity champions, state actors in the girls' education space, the risk of getting overtaken by the global agenda is quite high. Although we have recognized as a global community the importance of supporting and empowering local leaders, there is a degree of diplomacy that needs to happen to ensure local girls' education leaders are listened to, supported to, provided the resources that they need, and able to do their work on the ground. So I think that's a second level that we really need to pay attention to when we think about the skills that Diane and the panelists have highlighted for us. The third level is actually, you know, when you listen to the list of skills, you know, whether it's systems thinking, futures thinking, negotiation, communication, respect, trust building, these are actually skills that we're, when from a girls' education community, we talk about when we talk about life skills. These are skills that are critical for girls themselves to be able to develop and to use and to apply in their context, whether to negotiate for their continued education or to negotiate with their parents or family members or an uncle not to get married at a young age, right? So I think, you know, as we're thinking about education diplomacy, this isn't something new. It's something that we're talking about already. We just have a new framework to really think strategically about this and purposefully about this as we're talking about empowering and supporting local leaders and empowering and supporting girls as they face the challenges of their life. So to wrap up today, I wanted to attempt to draw some themes for all of us that I hope we'll take away. This morning's panel highlighted for us the unique moment that we find ourselves in, where we have an unprecedented number of high-level political actors and celebrity champions, and their engagement in girls' education clearly demonstrates the political stakes at risk should they and other global leaders fail to reverse the current statistic of over 130 million girls who are missing out on a primary and secondary education. Today's presentations by Sumbal and Eliana help to illustrate how state actors in Pakistan and Peru are finding themselves at an important crossroads for girls' education. They can either take the helm and ensure their country's most marginalized and overlooked girls can access and complete 12 years of quality education, or they can miss out on what promises to be an important turn of the tide in gender equality and development globally. I hope we'll soon be able to count the new Prime Minister of Pakistan and the government of Peru as new global champions in girls' education. So we'll be listening out for this in the next year or two. The presentations by Hawa and Jin showed us how much more progress we need to make in terms of equipping and supporting teachers with the knowledge, skills, and attitudes to provide girls with a gender-responsive learning experience, whether in early childhood or in adolescence. But if we are to leverage teachers as agents of change for girls, we have a long way to go in terms of bridging great policies with even better implementation in the classroom. We have even farther to go when it comes to tackling harmful gender stereotypes and mindsets that teachers might inadvertently manifest in the classroom that hold girls and boys back. We've heard isolated cases of positive deviance from our speakers in both panels, but we must aim to make sure that these exemplars, these exemplar teachers, are the norm rather than the exception. This brings me to another theme from today that takes us back to the topic of leadership. If we see teachers as among a possible cadre of civic leaders for girls' education, how do we ensure that their voices are heard in the policy sphere and by the global community? The panel on local leadership this morning illustrated for us not only what it means to empower and support local leadership, but also what's at stake when local leaders do not have the tools and resources they need to do their work more effectively, with greater impact, and at scale. The panel also showed us what's possible when local leaders are supported and provided with these things, as well as being recognized by the global community for their leadership. More specifically, I think we heard about the Valley of Death, middle-level financing gap from Adalo. This is something also that was featured heavily in CUE's Millions Learning Project on scaling. And I think also this thinking about how something as simple as this financing piece, not as simple, but can be simple, can curtail even the most successful local actors and local efforts. We heard from our other panelists this morning about the breadth of skills that are needed not only to navigate girls' education ecosystems of donors and influencers, but most importantly to also create important partnerships in what has increasingly become a connection economy where interpersonal relationships are at the driving force for action, impact, and change. And so now it brings me back here to the Center for Universal Education at Brookings, where we've used the last 6 years hosting the Akin and Global Scholars Program and our research behind the Obama Foundation's Global Girls Alliance to identify and reflect on what local leaders want and how local community members and global community members can best support this. The panel on education diplomacy you just heard reflects our understanding of the importance of socio-emotional skills in the work that our scholars return home to do, including self-awareness, social awareness, managing power dynamics, and building trust and respect, as well as persuasion. And because of their time here at Brookings, they have not only generated important evidence for policy change that affects girls' lives directly, but they have become exceptional leaders in the field. So you only heard from a few of our alumni today, and I encourage you in the networking hour to try to find all 26 who we have here in our audience to learn what they've done to move progress forward, what has helped them to do that, and what you can do to help support their efforts. So I want to congratulate our 2018 cohort of Akin and Global Scholars on their wonderful work and their successful completion of their residency period. I wish them all the best of luck. I wanted to also thank our many speakers and our moderators for really livening our discussions throughout the day. And especially I wanted to give a thanks to our team here, Amanda Braga, Aline Ponyonek, Lucy Jacobs, Katie Portnoy, and the rest of the team, Rhea, everyone who has helped with mics and staff our event, to really make this event happen today. So now I want to just formally close the day and invite everyone to our reception in Summers. Please enjoy and please do talk with all of the different, sorry, the foyer, not in Summers, foyer, important detail, our reception right outside. Thank you so much and have a wonderful day.